The Bayo Quartet formed in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and the members, Gio, Jason, Sean, and Ryan, they came to Pittsburgh in different ways. You'll hear their stories today in this episode. What's interesting is that they chose to stay in Pittsburgh, and not because of any university affiliation, but because their lives are in Pittsburgh. The quartet performs nationally, and this year the tour includes California, Maryland, North Dakota, Florida, Colorado, Maine, Virginia, North Carolina, and of course Pennsylvania. They have two CDs already recorded, and a third one is on its way. They have their own label, and they have their own recording studio. Welcome back to Accelerando. My name is Paula Tuttle, and today I'm with all four members of the Bayo String Quartets. And we talk about their story and whatever else comes to mind. We talk about their vision. We talk about fate and whatever steered the Bayo String Quartet to this road. Are they becoming an ensemble with a modern business plan? Let's find out. I'm in the Bayo String Quartet's recording studio and rehearsal space. And today, I'm with Jason and Sean Newcomb, the brothers that started the quartet. They play violin and viola, respectively. Also with Ryan Ash on cello and Bayo's newest member, Andrew Giordano. He plays violin. Welcome, everyone, to the Accelerando podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks.
Today we're finally getting together after an entire summer of trying to schedule this. I know Ryan and I have been trying to email each other about this, and you guys must be really super busy. So let's just start there. How was your summer? What were your highlights?
Yeah, our summer was great. I would say the highlight probably for all of us was the Lakeside Music Festival in Marblehead, Ohio. And we were there for 2 weeks. It's actually the Lakeside Chautauqua Festival.
For me, that was not the highlight. For me, the highlight was actually the birth of your daughter.
Yeah, well, I wasn't gonna speak for myself. I was speaking more for the group. But yes, in right before Lakeside, my daughter Helen was born. The middle of July,
like right before.
So it was like Lakeside. Right before. Yes.
You know, when really you said exciting. You were at Chautauqua. I was thinking Chautauqua, New York. This is a different Chautauqua.
That's right.
Apparently, there are a great number of Chautauqua communities I certainly didn't know about. They are all over the United States, and it's a great place to discuss philosophical ideas and swim in a lake. And normally, they have very strong arts programs.
They have really strong arts programs. Mm-hmm. I've been to Chautauqua, New York, and I've also been to the one in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh,
I mean, the festival there is in the Chautauqua area, but it's not as active. So this is an active Chautauqua in Ohio.
The one in Ohio that we are at, it's gated. You have to have a pass to get in. The one in Boulder, at this point, you don't need that. You can just go in. And I used to live in Boulder, so.
That's right. You were, yeah. Went to the University of Colorado at Boulder.
Exactly, yeah.
I know one other violinist that went there.
Yeah. The Takash String Quartet is in residence there, so that was why I was there.
When you guys were in North Dakota.
Both Sean and I did our undergraduates there. We are from a small town called Devil's Lake.
Which, believe it or not, when we were growing up, had its own Chautauqua. When I was, six, Jason was seven, our dad started us when we were 3 and 4. And we would always play for the Chautauqua series, and they'd have speakers come in. So it's funny, we were talking about it now. I just realized, oh, wow.
There's another Chautauqua.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, so was this in North Dakota?
Devil's Lake, North Dakota. But we did our undergrad at Minot State in Minot, North Dakota.
Right, because I've been to Minot, and I was like, can't believe
it. Oh, wow. No way.
Yes.
Sometimes people have heard of Minot. Nobody's ever heard of Devil's Lake. But sometimes people have heard of Minot because there's a big Air Force base there. So it brings
I think you have to drive through it if you're anywhere up there.
You're right.
You
the highway passes right through it.
You guys return there. You go there a couple times a year. You do concerts.
So we do a couple things there for the last maybe 6-7 years. We go back for a music festival called Dakota Chamber Music. We love getting to go back there because that's essentially Jason and mine's introduction to chamber music. The Jung Quartet was the group that they were bringing in at that point. And so every summer we would go and spend time with the Jung Quartet, and that's where we really learned our chamber music. And then when Bayo formed, we're like, natural progression, let's bring Bayo in. And so we've been going every year to Minot. And then now just this last year, they actually wanted to expand that role to have us be a form of artist in residence with the university. It's a fantastic school. And when we went to school there, we were with a pocket of people that just broke out and went everywhere. Catherine Borman plays in Cleveland Orchestra, a couple play in Dayton. We grew up at a really fantastic time with a group of us who have gone out into the professional music world. And it's just, there's that little town that had just an amazing violin teacher that made us all want to be there.
So are there any other residencies here? We've already talked about the Chautauqua in Ohio and then the one in North Dakota. Anything else on the horizon like this?
Bayo, I would say, really got its start doing the hardcore new music, contemporary music. And we were in residence at the Charlotte New Music Festival, where we would go each summer. We'd premiere maybe 12 full works, in addition to giving presentations on how to compose for the string quartet. And the big thing that we did there every year is we did a speed writing thing where all of the composers would have 2 weeks to write a 2 to 3 minute piece. We would get them on a Tuesday and perform all of them on the following Thursday, just 2 days later. And so that was
usually about 30 pieces.
Yeah, about 30 pieces. So that was always fun. But it was good for us to cut our teeth like that.
That's amazing. Are these music students mostly?
Some professionals, mostly college level, most doctoral level students. Mm-hmm. Some really great collaborations have come from that. We had a composition competition throughout the year. They'd collect scores. I think the first year was almost 200 scores were turned in. We would work with the Charlotte New Music Festival to pick one that we wanted to live with. And then we would put that on our program for the following year and record it. And we've maintained a lot of those relationships. That's been a really fulfilling residency in the past.
Well, I want to talk about your new albums. But before we get to that, I do want to go on this vein right here about your business model, because it's not like a normal quartet that's playing just traditional things. You guys are nurturing new works. So, you know, is this sort of a philosophy that you've had, or did it just sort of stem from the world we live in? Are quartets different today than they were a couple decades ago?
Probably yes to everything you're saying. I think it probably stemmed from this idea that when we formed, that we had discussions about what do we want out of our careers, what are the things that we're looking for. And if you really boil a lot of that down, I think that we want to be playing music at a high level with people that we want to be playing music with. We want to be playing music that we're passionate about. We have quite an eclectic taste of things we listen to. I love listening to heavy metal, for example. So quite a range of tastes. We want to be able to perform traditional, let's say, masterworks of the classical repertoire and the romantic repertoire. But we also love having new music, and not just contemporary music. It could be contemporary classical. I guess you could say crossover, although we don't like that term. And I think, is that fair to say that we really wanted to do the music that we want to do? And what the difficulty with that, of course, is presenters and reviewers and everybody wants to categorize. Oh, this is a new music group. This is a classical group. And we're really trying to push against that. So we're, you know, doing the music we want to be doing and not feeling limited.
And part of that's for the business model. I think that the majority of string quartets that have existed, they exist as part of a residency at a school. We've had even a fair number of highly established quartets say something to the effect of that is why they were able to stay together, literally. And when we formed Bayo, we had a list of strategies that we talked about up front. And one of those was that we are not interested in being a nonprofit. We're not interested in relying on grants to do our artistic projects. And it's not that we don't believe in those things. It's that, one, that is a pool that will eventually dry out. And maybe it's not sustainable as things move forward. But also, we live in an increasingly politicized landscape. Grant cycles are not untouched by that. Things go through influences and they're looking for specific things, where sometimes there are other things that are as important as the musical output. And for us, we want to make sure that we are putting specific aesthetic choices front and forward as much as we can. Because at the end of the day, if we're forming this quartet because we love this music and we want to play it with people that we love, that does not seem like that can coincide with having to match certain line items because you need to meet certain criteria.
Are you saying that tastes are becoming more inclusive or more divisive? And how do you find audiences that are open to traditional quartet rep and the new sounds?
Tastes are one thing. Expectations of presenters or granting organizations are a completely different thing. I think tastes are always varied because everyone comes from a different walk of life. And that is probably the thing that's the most rewarding about doing what we get to do, is we can play something that someone thinks they're not going to like because it's what they might think of as contemporary. And they inevitably like what they hear. So I think the tastes are a really fun part. The expectation, though, of things like categories and genre do become, I think, very limiting, and they can be very tricky to deal with, especially when it comes to presenting organizations or presenters. Look, I get it. They have a bottom line. They need to fill seats. They need to sell tickets. So they need to know their audience, and they need to know what they think their audience wants. But not everyone always knows what they want. And that is true in aspects of life across, of course, but I think especially in music. If someone, for instance, says, we don't want anything dissonant. Okay, what does dissonance mean to you? There are things in Gesualdo that are more dissonant than things that are written 20 years ago. But if you are going to categorize and say, this is classical, this is romantic, and you're going to use words are consonant or dissonant and put those as assign those as to what an audience is going to like, I think there are things that are going to slip through the cracks. And that's what our job is, we feel, is that we want to bring music to people to show them that music that was written 300-400 years ago all the way today, it all has stuff that's relevant to any listener right now, regardless of what their tastes might be.
And to go off of what Sean is saying about taste, one of my personal favorite things is when a presenter has been maybe, for a concert series, has been maybe a little wishy-washy about this particular piece that we really want to play, but they allow it, and then we come in and we perform it, and then inevitably the audience, we get tons of comments about, oh, this was my favorite piece. That, you know, something that the presenter maybe wasn't sure about, all of a sudden tons of audience members are like, oh wow, I've never heard anything like that before, I love it.
And different is good. You know, your concert that you played in La Trobe was really varied so that people get, you know, a little taste of different things. And I've noticed that that is often the case. The one song that sounds different gets a lot of attention. I was going to ask about inclusion, like what you were talking about, people accepting different kinds of things. Do you think that inclusion was established by media, like film scores, where people are used to music that underscores violence, and maybe audiences are craving a settled lifestyle in the midst of a technology-driven world that is disruptive and threatening? I want to lean into your album called Triggerland, and what you were thinking when you were creating this.
One of the tracks has electric bass, and one of the tracks has electric bass and guitar, but it's about string quartet. And it's very heavy music, both emotionally but also technical. The idea was, let's create an album that shows how strings, what strings can do in terms of virtuosity in this kind of a genre. You know, strings are an amazing family of instruments. We train and train and train, and we get out and we do cross genre, other multiple things, and we're holding this chord and we play this note and we do this to undertone, and that's fine, that has its place. But we just wanted to go a little on the opposite, say, look what virtuosity these instruments can do. So there's that side of Triggerland. But the side that I think you're referring to is the story.
There's a speaker underneath it. Did that text come from somewhere else?
I wrote all of that, and that was all written after all of the music was written. The music was written first. Part of what we're trying to do with all of our music is hit as wide a range of audience as possible. If this can tie in a story to this, it allows us to hit someone that might not otherwise want to listen to it. The last track I wrote, I actually called Triggerland, and the story came from that. We're all very passionate about topics that surround basically the ability to communicate with someone else. When you communicate, are you really being heard? Are you really communicating? Are you just throwing platitudes at each other with no real interest in moving forward? Triggerland has a gun on the cover, and it uses a gun as a central theme, but it's not actually about guns. It's about this idea that we become so ossified in what we think that we are not willing to listen to what someone else is actually really saying. And that doesn't allow anything to move forward. It's this point of stagnant motion. That place of stagnant motion is Triggerland. So all the text,
it's ready to explode.
It's a fictional place. It's a fictional land in some place that's not Earth, where nothing moves forward. And that's where the album starts, is a fairy tale. A creation myth about how a gun was created, and it leads to people wanting to make money off of it, and someone accidentally dies. But it's very tongue-in-cheek, very fairy tale-esque, and the idea is to juxtapose the seriousness and heaviness of both the issues that might surround that and the heaviness of the music. Is I think that music can allow people to see things differently, because when you're listening to music, you are truly experiencing someone else's sense of self. So here's a chance to maybe create a situation where someone might be able to think about something or experience something through the eyes of someone else, which we all know is a wonderful impetus for real conversation. And how do we move forward in any aspect of life without real conversation? That is all really the goal of what Triggerland is.
Let's hear from members of your quartet about what it's like to play the music that you wrote. Was it challenging? Did he use a lot of effects that were hard to understand?
Well, I'm probably the one who's furthest away from heavy metal or progressive rock in terms of my listening tastes. What pulled me into the music right away is that I can very clearly see its connection to classical tradition. There's motivic material, there's thematic material. It develops. The parts are interesting. They all have a clear function. And then we were talking about new genres or expanding people's tastes. Well, now I'm a metalhead and a progressive rock fan, whereas, you know, previously, you know, I wasn't.
Ryan has learned to play heavy metal on the cello.
Learning. Maybe we'll, you know, classical music has things that people are looking for. For other genres, maybe saying the rules of the game are different is maybe a little bit too glib, but I think that is true. There's different aspects that are important in those genres that are maybe less important in classical music and traditional classical music, and wrapping my head around those other characteristics actually has informed a lot of the classical playing, because something it's effective in another genre that I wasn't necessarily aware of. Oh, I bring it in and go, oh, well, now this passage in this classical quartet has much more power, much more rhythmic interest. It has a greater thrust, whereas before, you know, I might not have tied into that as easily.
One thing we did this summer to sort of give us a different perspective and see how others perform is the four of us all went to the progressive rock band Dream Theater concert in Cleveland, which was a really fun experience. We got to all four see them, which I think Dream Theater is Sean and Jason's maybe one of their favorite bands. I really like Dream Theater. And I think this was Ryan's first time ever getting to see them. So
I haven't seen Dream Theater.
They have been very active since the 80s. Is that true?
Correct.
They're really a giant, maybe the giant in the area. Certainly a giant sound. I could hear the concert very well from about 8 blocks away. So,
is that what we're going for with the string quartet? You want to be able to hear it 8 blocks away?
Well, you know, actually, funny that you say that, because that is a feature. But one thing that I like, since you were asking about what it's like to play Sean's music. Now, obviously, I've been playing Sean's music since for many, many years, and my dad's music as well. So I like that it is one foot in this camp of like heavier music, but I still can use all the tools that I trained to use in school and as a performer that often I'm asked to ignore if I am playing for other rock bands. So plenty of famous bands or famous rock shows, when you go and play for them, you're either told play very quietly or play very loudly, and that's your one dimension that you get to use.
Play whole notes.
Play whole notes, footballs, we call them.
Footballs.
And obviously I'm being a little bit overly reductive here, but that's sort of the direction that you tend to be asked to go in. And what I like is, if you listen to the album, we're playing a huge range of softs, louds, different colors, fuzzy colors, direct colors, focused sound, unfocused sound. All these things that we are doing in Beethoven, we're doing here as well. He's not really relying so much on something we might find in more contemporary music, but more in the craft, how things are put together, how the parts fit together. One thing you might notice if you listen to the album is the songs generally sound like verse chorus. A lot of them do, but if you listen to the string parts, they're not really like that. They're through composed, meaning they're evolving as they go along. So you kind of get this layer effect, and I think what's cool is that depending on the type of listener you are, you're going to get different things. If you're the type of listener who's sort of listening for the familiarity, you're going to get that with some of the choruses and verse type formats we're used to hearing on the radio. If you're someone who is looking for more variety and change and evolution and maybe ideas pulled from other places, you can find that in there too. So I think that's pretty neat. And that also means when we're learning the music, we're having to think about both of those sides.
Ryan, what's your favorite work on this album?
For me, it's a tie between two. Oh gosh, the titles have changed so frequently. I think it's Modern Cowboys, just because this one is just so huge in its scope. My other favorite is the title track, Triggerland, just because of its brain-melting rhythms. It's just endlessly fascinating.
I had a favorite one like months before the album came out, and that was definitely Modern Cowboys. Sort of for the reason Ryan says, which is, feels like this sort of journey. It makes me think of like a mini, like a Lord of the Rings type thing. To your point, how could you possibly just show the scene with Shelob and get the full effect without having also seen the Shire and then, you know, it's still great, but what makes it really impactful is that you have to, you've gone on this whole journey together. So it, that's what I like about the track Modern Cowboys. Now, there are other violinistic and quartet things that I also like about it, but I would say it's, I would say the adventure, the overall journey that wins me over.
And it has an adventurous title. Yeah, I love the title of that one. It drew me in because I love spaghetti westerns. What's the spaghetti western movement?
Yeah. If you like spaghetti, you should check out the music video for it online then, because it pulls from spaghetti westerns even more, the movie for it does for the Modern Cowboys.
Is the one that has a crazy violin duet.
Yeah.
So I guess I would tend to agree with both with Jason. It's a pretty crazy movement.
Sean, why did you write the other stuff?
I don't know. For some reason, it really does stick in my mind. Like,
which
that's
what,
the
which
one.
Movie was that?
Modern Cowboys.
It's, Modern
yeah.
Cowboys.
Yeah, it's the same. It's
also, you can tell this is a group of classical musicians talking about a rock track because we keep saying which movement. I meet you.
Yeah, right.
It's true. Well, we're trained well. Yeah. I'm not going to ask you what your favorite is. That would be like asking who's your favorite child. Speaking of children, I think you guys all have kids, right?
Correct.
How many kids do you have, Sean?
I have two boys. Mateo just turned 2 in July, and Alistair will turn 4 on September 11th.
Wow. And Ryan, you have kids.
Oh, just a daughter, Eleanor. She turned 1 in May.
Wow.
And she is a delight.
And we know that Helen was born in July.
Yeah, she was born July 13th. So she's almost 2 months now.
And so she's the only one. So you have more time.
She's our first, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Jason?
Yeah, I have a daughter named Luna who just started daycare yesterday. She's 9 months old.
How do you guys do it? I mean, your wives help a lot, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. This would be impossible without that
support. We're not a quartet. We're an octet with our wives, and then with our kids, we're even more. We decided early on that this was not a late stage capitalistic gain to build a business and have a career. This is our life. We love music. We love getting to play with one another. We want to show our kids what that actually means. And there's no words that we can ever use, but we can show them. And for me and Becky, that translated to, why are we waiting? We know we want kids. Let's let them be part of what we're trying to do right now.
And your dad was an educator as well.
That's right. He started a program in our hometown, Devil's Lake.
The strings program.
Strings program, that's right. Or revitalized it, I suppose. And he did it for 42 years? Mm-hmm. For 42 years before he retired. This is a small town, so he starts the kids, and he teaches all of them, violin, cello, bass, viola, all the way until they graduate. So the students there have him, how many years is that? Fourth grade through 12th grade, and then some of them continue to play after they graduate.
It draws a great picture of who you guys are.
So he wrote, ever since the 70s, he started writing pieces for his orchestras, mainly because, he might have a year where he doesn't have a lot of violas, or he has extra strong violas or extra weak violas or whatever. And so he'd write pieces to suit the orchestras that he has. And, 42 years later, he has over 300-400 works, and it's essentially a method of how to teach, because in all of his pieces, he wants everyone to have a good part, first of all, but also he's writing, this one has this rhythm and has this tonality, and then I'll teach that week. So each piece has pedagogical elements built in, and it's been probably about 15 years that Jason and I have been, in some respects, trying to find a way to get those works published. He would never do it on his own. He doesn't feel they need to be, but there's such good music in there. And part of the business model with Bayo, when we moved over to being a full-time LLC, is we developed a label and we developed a publishing branch. And the first thing that we've done with this publishing branch is we took 12 of Dad's works covering the three grade levels, and we engraved them. And they're the first things we published, and they're out for sale right now. And we're working on our next round of them. And the goal is to be releasing a couple new works every couple months and just have an ongoing thing where we can have all of his works out there available for his teachers, because they're really great works and they're designed for that level of students.
So what's the name of the label again?
The label is Newcraft Records.
N-E-U.
N-E-U-K-R-A-F-T.
And it's Bayo Publishing.
And Bayo Publishing is our publishing.
And by the way, that collection, for anybody listening, if you're interested, is the Richard Newcomb collection.
Yeah. We have companion CDs. Play along CDs that we've recorded so the kids can have an ear model to help them prepare the music. Your dad was also kind enough to write several level appropriate works so that Bayo can join the student ensemble as soloists. So when we come in to do a clinic of 2 or 3 days, we can round it out with performances with the students, for the parents. It's a nice cap. And it's a little bit different when we're working with the orchestra and asking them to do a certain kind of thing. Well, if we can join their sound along with ours, then I think that has a different impact.
So we're seeing another level to your business model. And on top of it, we're sitting in your recording studio, which is really nice. So you now have your own label for recording, a studio that you can let other musicians use. Right?
Eventually, that's the plan. We're getting there. There's still a couple other things we need to get in a row first, but that is the long-term plan, yeah.
This is going back a topic, that Triggerland exists as both an album, sound only, and as a feature-length film.
Yeah, it was featured actually in the Toronto and LA Contemporary Music and Dance Film Festival and took top prize for the full-length, feature-length category, and it's being presented and highlighted at different things for that, and so I'll be entering it in other film festivals throughout the next 6 months, but that was an interesting adventure to go on to make that movie.
Is it available on YouTube in its full length?
You can watch it as a playlist in its full length, but only as separate videos on YouTube.
So your next album is going to be J.S. Bach. Mm-hmm. So how's that going? You practiced it today, I assume.
It's the recording's in the can.
Yeah, actually, we recorded, finished for a few months.
We finished it in April. We're backlogged with shows coming up. When I say shows, I mean real, like, fully produced shows, not concerts. A massive show of Virginia Tech at the end of this month that uses, it's called a cube room, where every single area is a speaker. And so it's highly technical. We're working with Charles Nichols for that show. And we have another show at the end of October that's a full crossover project called Future Languages for drums and electronics and everything. So we're building out those shows right now. So the Bach album is sitting on the back burner. It's almost edited. And we'll release it probably in February, we're looking at, of 2024.
So all of you play in the community. You play in other symphony orchestras. You obviously take something from the quartet and then you go into these other orchestras, whether it be just to fill out your calendar or whatever, and then you can bring it back to the group and you feel refreshed.
You're probably going to get a different answer from each of us. For example, I don't think Sean plays with any groups in the area. Ryan, you're starting to more, and I've been playing in the area for so many years that I've, if anything, been...
Didn't you play Wheeling like a couple of days ago?
I did.
I saw your picture online, so I know.
So, if we don't have a concert or something booked, I like to play in local groups. I love the orchestral repertoire. Quartet is definitely my favorite thing to do. We miss a lot of the great music out there that's out there. So I really like playing music. And the other thing is this, I've been doing it for so many years. I actually find it really fun to go and see people I don't always get to otherwise see in those groups.
That's Collies. How I know you.
Exactly, you know? Exactly.
Yeah, I remember seeing you backstage at Lincoln Park many years ago.
Well, part of that I think is a lot of quartets may form in the university environment, meaning either as students or as teachers or professionals who are teaching at the school who come together to put together a group. I believe that was the Cleveland Quartet's genesis. What needs to happen with the student group is then they leave the university environment and then there's a jolt of real life, logistics, bills, all those sorts of things. And a lot of groups fragment and are not able to continue, or they decide not to continue their regular quartet activities. But all of us existed and were self-sufficient outside of school when we decided to form the group. I think that gives Bayo some firm footing to continue to build the quartet and be able to do more and more with the group as we need to.
You've all located to Pittsburgh. I know you guys, the brothers, were here to go to school, but Ryan and Gio, you came here for the quartet. So here we have Pittsburgh is home to a string quartet that's performing nationally. What keeps you in Pittsburgh? I'm not sure that we can say the same thing happened with another quartet that has been here that isn't associated with a college, as you said.
Well, I think Ryan and I actually came here for slightly different reason, mm-hmm. right?
So I've been in Pittsburgh, now I've passed the 10-year mark. I think I've earned my stripes. I originally came because there was a need at a teaching studio. Gio, you came for pure quartet reasons in that you had played in the Altius Quartet for 9 years out in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And when we had a need for a violinist, we really had one name on our list. We thought, hey, Gio would be really great. Let's give him a call.
Well, yeah.
So you knew Gio?
Yeah, because we had all met at the Chamber Music America Conference in 2019, I think it was, or 2018, one of those years, before the pandemic.
Right.
So I was with Altius Quartet, and then during the pandemic, Altius Quartet disbanded, and Bayo happened to be looking for a violinist, and I happened to be still wanting to play chamber music for a career.
So
it all kind of worked out that we all sort of found each other at the right time. And it worked out that my wife and I were able to make it work to move here so that I could continue playing chamber music. So
yeah, it's a great fit.
And in regards to Pittsburgh, I actually came to Pittsburgh to study at Carnegie Mellon. Sean did not. Sean was living in New Zealand at the time.
I was. I'd finished school in Cleveland. I played with Nashville Symphony for a couple of years, and then I moved to New Zealand. And then I was sick of not being in the same town as Jason. So he was here finishing up his artist diploma. He's like, I'm coming to Pittsburgh. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to Pittsburgh.
So you're the Kevin Bacon of the group.
That's right. But, you know, the thing I love about Pittsburgh now is the same thing I loved about it back then. I would say even more so now, as it has changed in the last 15 years. First of all, there's a lot of cultural events. Not only Pittsburgh Symphony, but you have many orchestras in the area. Even smaller operas. There's the Pittsburgh Opera, but there's
Pittsburgh Festival Opera.
Yes, and you know, smaller ones, Microscopic Opera, and
the one that just did Hamlet at Carrie Furness Quantum Theater.
So there are quite a few performing groups already, and there is an audience of people who come to these things and want to be part of it. And not that we have any time to go to concerts these days anymore anyways, but if I want to go see a concert, there is so much going on. And it's not just music, the arts as well. Speakers, exhibits, it's a lot going on here.
Arts festivals,
right. Yes. And then there's a practical reason we like Pittsburgh also, which is that it's a great hub to get to other places to perform. It's driving distance to almost anywhere on the at least the Upper East Coast. We're in West Virginia a lot, Ohio. The Midwest stuff is just, it's either a short flight or a longer drive, but either is doable.
We're about to go to Indianapolis to perform for a conference, a Midwest conference. And I think if we lived too far east, that would be a flight that we'd have to take, or maybe a two-day drive. As it is, it's not going to be that big a hassle to get there. To Second Jason, we live in an area where we can get to most places on the East Coast, but we can also get to the Midwest, which is really nice.
I might just say just a quick few words about the label, because it's one thing, you know, in this day and age, what is a label? Why is it needed or not needed? And when we started contemplating wanting to release records and albums, first it's like, well, what's the point of releasing an album or releasing a record? And then what are we going to release? And we started having our plans for like Triggerland and things along those lines, Heartsleeve Triptych, Ghosts Revisited, 131. These cover a mass range of genres, and we're like, well, I don't know if we're going to find a label that will house all of those. But then also, it comes down to the idea of ownership. Then that means we don't own any of our own music. And not that it's going to pull in piles and piles, but that's beyond the point.
It is the point. A lot of people are learning this way after the fact that they don't own their music. Somebody else owned it, and they're making a lot of money. Somebody else is making a lot of money.
And that's the whole thing, is everyone makes money off of what musicians do, and the musicians don't always get that. And so we said, let's start a label. Really, it took me about 10 years to build a pretty decent home studio when we really branched out. I spent the year designing the studio that we're sitting in now, and I just have to say that for the 131 album we released last January, we got, I think, 3 5-star reviews from Fanfare, and out of all the other publications that reviewed us, almost every single one of them talked about the actual recording quality, comparing it to Deutsche Grammophon and all these others. I'm only bringing it up because that is something that we've spent a lot of time thinking about. How is the string quartet to be heard? Or when we do something like Triggerland, it took me 10 years to find a way to actually design the sound for it to work. I don't think it's as simple as just saying we want to do pop or we want to do rock and here's a string quartet and throw a mic on. The thing that our instruments do that's so amazing is the nuance of color and texture. And when you play an electric instrument, an actual electric violin, to me, that's just a different instrument. It's fine, and we can play it because we play violin.
It doesn't have the sympathetic nature. That's what I love about a string quartet, is that if you're really in sync, it rings among each other. So with an electric violin, do you get that?
You lose it. It becomes a different thing. The way we mic, the way we record, the way we do crossover, the way we amplify when we do all of our crossover shows, all of that is a huge part of what the label allows us to do. I was just invited to become a member of the Recording Academy, which is huge, because that means that now I'm able to submit anything from Newcraft Records for Grammy nominations. You know, we're not deluding ourselves thinking we're going to get anything like that. But we can be an actual player now with the voting. And that's why I also like that we're in Pittsburgh, is that Pittsburgh is our home. We're building this thing here. But we very much want to be aware of the global stage of what music is and where it's going. Because everyone who's our age or younger or whatever, but anyone who's dedicated themselves to music, we are the music industry, all of us. We should be the ones who are directing it.
And you're setting an example for anybody who's trying to get out into the music business too. You're saying, make a label. Make your own business.
Well, we'll see if we can make it.
You're a brand, the Bayo brand. Getting back to the spaghetti western thing.
That's right.
Maybe we should mention the City of Asylum show.
It's coming up soon.
February 27th.
I love that place. What are you going to play there?
I don't know what we're going to play there. I'm sure you know.
When you say that, is that Opus 131?
So it's an album. The album's called 131. the Bach one that's coming up next year, we call them classical concept albums, and the idea is that to show that albums are still relevant. In other words, it's a piece, it's an album that's meant to be listened to from front to end, that there's a reason why it's an album, it's not disparate works combined. Happened to be on a disc. That album has a piece by American composer Missy Mazzoli, a fantastic piece called Enthusiasm Strategies, a classical work of mine called 1920 that deals with arts in the pandemic and on whose shoulders does supporting arts fall, this kind of stuff. And it ends with 131, Beethoven, the famous Opus 131. Yeah, we are huge Beethoven buffs, all four of us, so we try to play as much Beethoven as we can.
So what's coming up in Pittsburgh?
January 24th at noon at the Pitt Student Union.
That would be great. I'll be there.
For anybody who wants to see what we're up to, we post frequently on our social media stuff. So that's Bayo String Quartet, and that's, you know, Instagram and Facebook mostly. Rehearsal clips, travel pictures, behind the scenes, anything like that.
And follow us on YouTube as well.
That's right.
Thanks to the Bayo Quartet for talking to us on a Cellerando podcast today. If you heard the entire podcast, you'll want to check out the show notes at acellerandocast.com. There will be links for the Bayo website and their YouTube channel. If you're new to Cellerando, this podcast has been published weekly for well over a year now. I interview musicians often and present ideas related to music and the classical music profession. You can share this podcast and maybe even subscribe on Apple Podcasts. You can also hear any of the last 70 episodes on the website at cellerandocast.com. As you know, I like to urge listeners to support live music and the musicians that bring it to our communities. So many ways to do that. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.